more than 2 billion people called Elizabeth their queen. The Royal Impact covers 56 nations in the British Commonwealth. King Charles III spoke to them today.
I shall endeavor to serve you with loyalty, respect, and love, as I have throughout my life.
Also ahead, a scandal they're calling Greek Watergate. The government spied on opposition politicians and journalists, a punch in the gut to those whose lives were violated.
Fear, agony. We're talking about an invasion in the family life.
And one byproduct of soaring temperatures.
People tend to be more aggressive online when it's too hot or too cold outside.
Rage tweeting in the heat. I'm Marco Werman. All of that and more coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us this Friday. Gun salutes across the United Kingdom today in honor of Queen Elizabeth II. 96 shots for each of the years she was alive. And bells to mark the passing of the Queen and the ascension to the throne of her son, King Charles III. He made his first remarks as the new monarch today in London.
In a little over a week's time, we will come together as a nation, as a commonwealth, and indeed a global community, to lay my beloved mother to rest.
We'll speak more about the role that King Charles may play across the British Commonwealth in just a bit. But first, a visit to some former British territories where Queen Elizabeth's legacy is being remembered today. We start in Canada with reporter Anita Elash in Toronto.
Elizabeth toured Canada for the first time in 1951, when she was still a princess. Thousands of children lined the streets to see her and Prince Philip.
Princess waves to the children, and how they respond. There's the Duke waving now.
6 years later, the capital city, Ottawa, nearly doubled its population when Queen Elizabeth became the first monarch to open a session of the Canadian Parliament.
Pray be seated. Pray be seated.
Lynn Ellis, who moved to Canada from Scotland as a child in the 1960s, says the Queen was always part of her life.
She was on the stamps, she was in our schoolrooms, you know, she was always very much here.
She says she admires the Queen for her personal strength and sense of duty.
She was brought up in an era where this was what you were supposed to do, and she took the ball and ran with it, and she never wavered.
Polls have shown that, unlike Ellis, most Canadians are indifferent to the monarchy. For them, even Tim Hortons, the iconic Canadian donut shop, is a bigger part of their identity. Jack Jedwab, director of the Association for Canadian Studies, says that's because most people have no idea what the Queen's role was.
The Queen still plays a role, however symbolic, in terms of our institutions and certainly in terms of our history, but you know, the knowledge about Canada's history isn't something that's particularly strong right now.
The Queen is represented in Canada by the Governor General, who can refuse to sign laws or dissolve Parliament, but almost never does. As Queen, Elizabeth took part in almost every significant moment in Canada's recent development. Historian and monarchist Barry McKenzie says that through it all, she refused the temptation to exercise her power or to hold on to old institutions.
Maybe there were moments when she wished she could have expressed her true feelings, but was most concerned about supporting Canada and to supporting Canadians and celebrating them for who they are, regardless of what that might mean.
As a result, McKenzie says, the Queen leaves Canada as a stronger, more vibrant democracy. For The World, I'm Anita Elash in Toronto.
And I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi. Elizabeth II was born a princess in England, but it was here in Kenya where she became queen. In February 1952, Elizabeth arrived on a Commonwealth tour with her husband, Prince Philip.
Nairobi was naturally determined to look its very best for the royal visit. Though it's only about 50 years old, the capital of Kenya is a fine city over 5,000 feet above sea level. And with all the decorations up, it looked very gay indeed.
Back then, Kenya was a British colony with a large white settler population. Princess Elizabeth toured hospitals and met with the British colonial administration.
The contrast we see today is a striking tribute to the men and women of all races who have made it a great center of commerce and finance, the crossroads of East Africa, the capital of your colony, and the seat of the East Africa High Commission.
Then she moved on to the foothills of Mount Kenya.
About 100 miles away, Sagana Forest Lodge was also to be visited. This attractive place was a wedding gift from the people of Kenya. Its quiet seclusion and charm was bound to be greatly appreciated by the royal visitors on this and no doubt future occasions.
It was there that she learned her father, King George VI, had died. Now she was queen of an empire on the cusp of change and upheaval. Soon Kenyans joined other African countries to fight against violent British colonial rule. In 1963, Kenya became independent. In downtown Nairobi, I meet 66-year-old Dominic Mwangi, who sells newspapers. News about Queen Elizabeth's death graces the front pages. Mwangi tells me he was only a child during the colonial period, but he remembers it being a difficult time for Kenyans. Still, he says he's mourning the Queen's death. She was the leader of many countries before independence, he says. Kenya and Britain have maintained a close relationship over the decades, and today Kenya remains part of the Commonwealth. Mwangi says that's a good thing. For the younger generation, though, memories of the British Empire are long gone, and British influence is fading. Shirley Kimuma is a 23-year-old university student in communications.
Though we have been colonized by them, I don't feel attached to them.
Still, she says, it's sad for the UK to have lost a leader. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
And I'm Sandeep Roy in Kolkata, once Calcutta, the second city of the British Empire, the capital of the British Raj. Its most iconic monument is the Victoria Memorial, a marble edifice in memory of Queen Elizabeth's great-great-grandmother, Queen Victoria. Even after independence in 1947, some Raj nostalgia remained. So says Malavika Banerjee, who runs the Kolkata Literary Meet.
For instance, my in-laws, I have heard stories about how in 1952, a full ship was hired and all the men of the family sailed to the UK to attend the Queen's coronation.
That nostalgia has largely dissipated today, except for pockets like Banerjee's mother-in-law, who was glued to the television yesterday.
They were waiting for an announcement, and my poor father-in-law could not watch cricket because she was just not allowing anyone to move away from the BBC.
The Queen visited Kolkata in 1961 as part of her first royal tour to India with Prince Philip. They visited the Victoria Memorial, the Cathedral, and the horse races.
The Royal Calcutta Turf Club provided a favorite form of relaxation for the Queen at its spring meeting. Chief race on the card was the Queen Elizabeth II Cup.
English professor Niladri Chatterjee says the Queen's Cup still happens every year in Kolkata.
So there's one very tangible legacy of that visit.
Chatterjee got into the royals after watching the wedding of Charles and Diana.
I remember watching the wedding on our black and white television, and I thought, who are these people?
Fascinated by the role of the monarchy in modern progressive nations, he started researching it. Now, he has quite a royal collection.
I think, you know, probably about 10 to 15 books, about 20-odd stamps, about 10 or so postcards.
The pride of place goes to photographs he himself took of the Queen when he saw the Trooping the Colour ceremony in London.
The actual parade starts at around 10:30, 11, and I was there at 6. So I could get a very, very good position, yes.
This happy nostalgia doesn't prevent Indians from also being aware how colonialism ravaged India. While Chatterjee is fascinated by the Queen as a public figure, he certainly doesn't want the British back.
So if they were to rule in India, I think I would probably join the freedom fighters.
As for Banerjee, she actually has a piece of the Queen's Kolkata legacy. Her husband co-owned horses that have won the Queen's Cup.
That's one happy connection between Calcutta and the Queen that I think will endure, and I wonder whether it'll now be called the King's Cup.
For The World, this is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
King Charles III is now the head of state of the United Kingdom and 14 other countries. This evening in London, he made his first address in that role.
Wherever you may live in the United Kingdom or in the realms and territories across the world, and whatever may be your background or beliefs, I shall endeavor to serve you with loyalty, respect, and love.
To find out what kind of monarch Charles might be, I spoke with Richard Drayton. He's a professor of imperial and global history at King's College London. It is hard to resist comparing King Charles to his mother.
I think that Queen Elizabeth II was particularly popular. I mean, I think the advantages simply of old age and of a kind of benign grandmotherly persona came to her. And it's hard to think of Charles ever in his reign achieving that level of self-evident status as the center of national politics. Charles also, it has to be said, has had a rather complex life in the 20th century, in which he has been involved in a number of public controversies of one sort or another. I do think that he is someone of exceptional gifts who would probably have been quite an interesting figure as sovereign had he come to the throne when he was a man of, say, 50.
He does have some intriguing interests. He is his own man. How is he viewed in the wider Commonwealth?
I think in the wider Commonwealth, he's something of a question mark. There would be an older generation that might remember Charles going out to Australia to do a season in the colonies and coming along to visit here and there. But by and large, I think he's a somewhat unknown figure. His relationship with Princess Diana is ancient history, something which only people over the age of 30 or 40 would know anything about. So he comes, I think, as something of a blank slate onto which the British royal household can, if they are clever, script narratives of one sort or another to protect his particular charisma as a potential head of state of Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and even Jamaica.
Let's take one area that King Charles has shown interest in, and that's the environment. And a lot of nations in the Commonwealth are island nations facing really an existential threat from climate change. How much could King Charles focus on climate action?
I'm sure that Charles will make climate change, among other issues, questions to which he will speak and seek to address. But the nature of his role is that both within and outside of Britain, he has next to no real power. He does have some institutional power within Britain. There's a tradition of the monarch being consulted over certain kinds of legislation. But the extent to which Charles would have the capacity to move the agenda, I would be somewhat skeptical.
King Charles will lead the Church of England, but he's also been described as supporting and embracing many faiths. How will his relationship to faith and religion shape his role as monarch, do you think?
I think that he will be a bit like the Church of England itself. What the Church of England became by the late 20th and early 21st centuries is, in fact, one of the kinds of leaders in interfaith conversations with Roman Catholics and later on with Muslims. And so Charles, I think, is not original in his multi-faith posture, a way of negotiating the crown's role as the preeminent institution of the nation in a way that recognizes that this is a multi-faith society in a multi-faith commonwealth.
It's interesting. Queen Elizabeth took the throne when she was just 25. Charles is now 73. He's been groomed his entire life for this role. But at 73, I'm wondering, what effect will that have on how he might rule?
Well, I suppose there are two options. You could argue that on the one hand, he might think that there's nothing to be lost and he could be an old man behaving badly. I suspect that will not be the path he takes. I think that he will believe it is his responsibility to protect the monarchy as an institution for future generations. He's no longer the kind of young man with something to prove that he was when he was arguing with modern architects or touting the advantages of organic farming or getting involved, calling in people to discuss laws that were going before Parliament. I think that the Charles who will come to the throne now will be someone who will be essentially managing the operation for his son and for his son's son.
Richard Drayton is a professor of imperial and global history at King's College London. Richard, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
Later this hour, more coverage of the Queen's legacy. We go to Ghana. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. North Korea passed a new law yesterday. It allows for preemptive nuclear strikes if it perceives a threat to the country or its leaders. This comes as U.S. and South Korean officials believe Pyongyang is ready to resume nuclear testing for the first time since 2017. Jenny Town is well-versed in North Korea's nuclear program and ongoing efforts by the West to contain it. She joins us now from the Stimson Center in Washington. So preemptive strikes, Jenny, using nukes first. Has North Korea, or any nation for that matter, ever suggested this before?
Well, North Korea certainly hasn't in doctrine, even though they have started to hint of this over the past couple of months and some of the statements that they've been making that have largely been sparked by, you know, South Korea's rhetoric about the use of preemptive strikes on North Korean targets.
I mean, it's not just the idea of preemptive strikes, but the law says those strikes would occur when it is determined that the country's leadership is facing an imminent, quote, nuclear or non-nuclear attack by hostile forces. So is it clear to you who would make that determination?
You know, there's a lot of questions that are raised from this new law. There is a clause that says that Kim Jong-un has sole authority over the command and control of nuclear use. It also explains that there is this group of advisors within the State Affairs Commission, which is the highest political body there, that would advise him on this. But the other part of that clause says, in the case of danger to Kim Jong-un or this, you know, state authority, that a nuclear attack would be automatic.
Right.
And so we start to see this idea of delegated authority where it isn't just Kim Jong-un, but if something happens to him, if he is incapacitated, there is a plan in place and that plan is likely to go nuclear.
And that automatic plan also says those nuclear strikes against enemy forces would target their starting point of provocation and the command. Help us understand what that means.
You know, obviously, whatever country initiates that, you know, certainly they would target wherever that strike came from. For instance, if the U.S. made the decision to use nuclear weapons, if it came from a missile in Guam, then, you know, this would then target both Guam and the United States, as an example.
Well, what are the implications for the U.S.? How do you reckon Washington is seeing this new law and thinking about it?
Well, the U.S. and South Korea, especially, you know, it certainly does make real the possibility of nuclear use early in a conflict. And this whole preemptive doctrine creates a lot of room for miscalculation and a lot of room for, you know, rapid escalation of any kind of questionable moves or misread signals in the region.
Yeah, I mean, let's not go all Dr. Strangelove here, but what are the risks of an accident now that this North Korean law is in the books?
This is so much now perception-based that it makes it very difficult, you know, even in the idea of staging live fire exercises, joint exercises like what the U.S. and South Korea, you know, presumably run, could lead to some wrong interpretations of the events unfolding, especially when we don't have, you know, solid communication channels that could carry messages back and forth.
I mean, North Korea pops up pretty regularly in our news cycle. They're testing a missile or doing something to provoke the U.S. or South Korea. We've been kind of gotten accustomed to an almost boy cries wolf pattern. But what about this latest news? More bluster? Or do you see it as a really serious threat?
I think it's a serious threat. But certainly, you know, they also couch in that they don't want war. The beginning posture is still defensive in nature. And I think, you know, as much as the threat is there, there's still likely to be kind of a high threshold for making those decisions.
Jenny Town is a senior fellow at the Stimson Center and the director of 38 North. She was helping us understand the North Korean decision to allow for the preemptive use of nuclear weapons. Jenny, thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco. It was a pleasure.
This week, Syria accused Israel of bombing the airport in the Syrian city of Aleppo. The Israeli government typically refuses to confirm or deny these attacks, but Israel has said that it will target militia groups inside Syria that are aligned with Iran. On the ground in Syria, it's a murky situation. There are many different groups operating there right now with very different interests. And remember, the U.S. still has about 1,000 troops based there. The world's Shirin Jafari has the latest.
Grainy videos posted online show the aftermath of what's described as an Israeli airstrike at the airport in Aleppo, Syria. Security guards survey damage to the runway, which is pockmarked and cratered. Three people reportedly died in the attack. This is the second time in a week that Israel has targeted the same airport. Earlier this summer, Israel reportedly bombed the Damascus airport too, forcing it to shut down for a few days. Syria described the most recent attack as a war crime. But to Israelis like Asaf Orion, these attacks are justified because of what Iran is doing just across the border in Syria.
For the last 5 years or so, Israel has been struggling against an Iranian campaign to build a military deployment threatening Israel from up close, from Syria and from Lebanon.
Orion is a retired brigadier general who served in the Israel Defense Forces. He describes the Iranian buildup of military assets around Israel like a ring of fire. He says given the opportunity, Iran and its proxies will use those capabilities to attack Israel.
Israel is quite fond of its survival. So what we are doing is rather than waiting for a formal war to be declared, we degrade those capabilities.
So not a formal war, but an undeclared one that's been raging for years, and it could spiral into something worse.
There certainly is the potential for there to be miscalculations between military forces that could lead to an escalation.
Miles Kagins III is a former spokesperson for the U.S.-led coalition against ISIS. He is now with the Council on Foreign Relations. Those U.S. military forces in Syria are there to prevent ISIS from coming back. But Kagins says their presence means they're also a target. Sometimes, in response to Israeli operations, it's the Americans who face retaliation from militia groups.
Those attacks have been happening on and off for the past 2.5 to 3 years. And typically they're not effective, but they're certainly deadly in their intentions.
Former IDF General Asaf Orion tells me that Israel gives warnings to the U.S. before it carries out strikes in Syria. In the past, that has helped avoid disasters. But experts say the possibility of escalation is still there. As to why Israel targets airports, Miles Kagan says Iran is using civilian airports in Syria to transfer weaponry.
Ground agents who normally would be inspecting this cargo equipment and reviewing the manifest, they're all in some way paid for or aligned with Iranian interest.
The Syrian government has to decide if it's worth the risk to allow these transfers to continue. That's according to Qotayba Idlibi, senior fellow with the Atlantic Council. He says on the one hand, Syrian President Bashar al-Assad doesn't want to alienate Iran, which has helped him survive a civil war.
But we see more lower-ranking, whether officers or media spokesmen usually or influencers who are connected to the regime, calling out Iran after those attacks and asking for, you know, the reduction of Iranian investment.
Idlib says after 11 years of conflict, many Syrians are exhausted and the last thing they want is to be involved in a larger proxy war between Iran and Israel. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. She was the Queen of England, also the Queen for many Africans. In Ghana, despite colonialism, Elizabeth II is still revered.
She's a woman and she has seen a lot, been through a lot, but come out with her head held high. So I think it's that inspiration.
Also, Europe's plan to stay warm this winter, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. It's a scandal that some are calling Greek Watergate, leading to the resignation of Greece's head of intelligence and the prime minister's chief of staff. The Greek government was accused of placing spyware on the smartphones of journalists and an opposition lawmaker. The revelations center around a relatively new spyware known as Predator. It can turn a cell phone into a mobile surveillance machine with just one click. As The World's Duri Biskaran reports, the scandal that started in Athens is now reverberating across Europe.
First, Greek journalist Thanasis Koukakis noticed that his phone would run out of battery faster than he expected.
I changed the battery, but it was still not working properly.
And the phone wouldn't ring when he dialed a call. He'd just get connected. It was fishy. Koukakis is an investigative reporter who writes for major outlets like the Financial Times and CNN Greece. He specializes in rooting out corruption and financial fraud. So when he started to suspect something was up, he had a source he could call.
He told me that, you know, you are under surveillance from the Greek authorities.
Koukakis was shocked.
And I asked him, to provide me something tangible.
Some proof that his phone had been hacked by the government. 2 weeks later, the source sent him a transcript of a call that Koukakis took while waiting to pick up his daughter from school. He felt violated.
Fear, agony. We're talking about an invasion in the family life. It's a matter of a great concern, that, you know, something that we are still discussing inside my house.
Through meticulous investigation of his own case, Koukakis learned that his phone was compromised twice with a surveillance malware called Predator. Its origins are murky, but security experts have tied Predator to the Greek firm Intellexa, which promotes its services to governments and law enforcement agencies this way.
Criminals operating under an encrypted multi-digital ecosystem have made data collection virtually impossible.
Encrypted messaging apps like WhatsApp and Telegram are popular in Europe because they let you avoid international calling fees by using an internet connection. But these calls can't be recorded by traditional wiretaps. Predator can record encrypted calls, but it can also access your photos, emails, contacts. It can activate your phone's camera and microphone, an all-inclusive spying buffet.
From pedophiles to organized terror groups, human trafficking, or financial fraud, we give you the power to investigate.
In Greece, there's now widespread concern that this power to investigate has gone too far. This summer, the leader of Greece's third largest political party and a member of the European Parliament, Nikos Androulakis, found traces of an attempted Predator installation on his phone and learned that he had been under surveillance by Greek intelligence.
And this is when it turned into a political scandal.
Nick Malkoutsis is an Athens-based political analyst who founded the website Macropolis.
And the idea that the leader of an opposition party would be spied upon for reasons of quote-unquote national security could mean anything.
During a parliamentary inquiry, the scale of conventional wiretapping in Greece emerged. One prosecutor authorized the wiretapping of almost 16,000 phones last year, an average of about 43 per day. Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis said that surveillance of the opposition lawmaker was a mistake, but claimed that the wiretaps were within the boundaries of what is legal. He claimed that his government did not use spyware against civilians. Nick Malkoutsis says Greek voters are unconvinced. After all, the Prime Minister's general secretary, who resigned amid the scandal, is also his nephew.
The opinion polls we've had over the last couple of weeks, around two-thirds of Greeks believe that the prime minister is directly responsible for the phone tapping of Androulakis. So they do think that there is a political connection there.
The Greek government has denied that it ever purchased Predator. But Malkoutsis says that doesn't rule out its use through a third party or contractor. In Brussels, home of the European Parliament, lawmakers fear that the spyware scandal in Greece is only the tip of the iceberg. An analysis by Citizen Lab, a cybersecurity watchdog, concluded that Predator's likely customers include the governments of Armenia, Serbia, Egypt, and many others.
We move immediately to our hearing.
Now, a series of hearings are being held to investigate how spyware could possibly be regulated in the European Union. Claudio Guarnieri heads Amnesty International's Security Lab in Berlin.
Some called it a crisis of democracy. I see it rather as a late reckoning with the reality of an abusive mercenary spyware industry, which has been allowed to flourish unchecked for quite a long time.
In testimony last week, Guarnieri detailed a dizzying network of European spyware manufacturers who sell malware through their subsidiaries, avoiding export regulations.
Spyware is an extremely invasive piece of technology that allows for many forms of access at once, intercepting communication, location tracking, seizing data at rest, turning the devices in an environmental bug, which are all different kinds of investigative powers that are all combining one.
It's an unprecedented amount of access, he said. And wresting control of this industry will be like trying to put a genie back in a bottle. For The World, I'm Derry Biscarin.
You may have heard the hype that cockroaches could survive a nuclear blast. Not true. If you want an indestructible animal, check out the tardigrade. News This Week suggests they are so indestructible, tardigrades, also known as water bears, can survive 10 years without water. Researchers at the University of Tokyo have just documented in new detail how they do it. Thomas Boothby is an assistant professor and researcher at the University of Wyoming, and he knows these animals really well. Professor, the research paper from Tokyo is called Stress-Dependent Cell Stiffening by Tardigrade Tolerance Proteins that Reversibly Form a Filamentous Network in Gel. So we'll get you to unpack some of that in just a sec. But first of all, tell us about tardigrades. What are they? What do they look like? And why are they called water bears?
Yeah, absolutely. So tardigrades, or water bears, as they're sort of commonly known, are a group of microscopic animals. So they're teeny, and you need a microscope to see them. If you would look at them under a microscope, what they look like are sort of these chubby little eight-legged gummy bear type things.
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah. And why people are particularly interested in these like small diminutive animals is that they are particularly hardy. They're actually some of the, if not the toughest animal that we know of. So tardigrades can survive environmental extremes that we typically think of as being sort of restrictive to life. So this includes things like being frozen, being heated up past the boiling point of water, being exposed to thousands of times as much radiation as you or I could survive, or going for days or weeks with little to no oxygen. Tardigrades have also been shown to survive prolonged exposure to the vacuum of outer space. And really, sort of germane to the research article that just came out, tardigrades can also survive being desiccated or dried out.
Yeah, and that's really fascinating. I know you were not part of the research team at the University of Tokyo, but you've seen the paper. What does it add to the scientific knowledge of tardigrades? In short, how do they do this? How do they survive these extreme conditions, especially the being dried out part?
Yeah, absolutely. So tardigrades use many different tricks to survive these environmental extremes, including drying out. One of the sort of tricks or tools that tardigrades have are these really special proteins known as cytoplasmic abundant heat soluble proteins. Mm. So the Japanese group was looking at these CHS proteins, and what they found is that these CHS proteins are able to polymerize together to form a gel-like sort of filamentous network. And excitingly, they showed this not only in vitro, so in a test tube in sort of an artificial laboratory setting, but they actually showed this within cells. So these tardigrade proteins form these gel-like scaffolds within cells, which is thought to be highly protective.
And so if a cell is like a room, when water starts to escape, that room doesn't collapse. It just stays strong, kind of thanks to that gel.
Exactly. When water's lost, the cell's sort of natural inclination would have been to shrink down. But because of this sort of gel scaffold within the cell, it actually, the cells are able to retain their original shape.
So thanks to this research from Tokyo, we know more about how tardigrades protect their cells. What can humans do with that knowledge?
Well, I think that, you know, if we understand the tricks that tardigrades and other stress-tolerant organisms use to protect themselves during sort of environmental extremes, you know, we can use that knowledge to, say, engineer crops that are better able to handle Earth's changing climate. Mm. Another sort of real-world application of this type of research is if we understand how tardigrades are able to stabilize their cells and sensitive biological material, we could apply those same tricks to stabilizing things that we as humans really care about. So say, you know, using some of these same tricks to stabilize vaccines so you don't have to keep vaccines refrigerated or frozen. This would be hugely beneficial in terms of logistics and economics of getting medicine to everyone everywhere.
So back to the cockroach hype, could tardigrades survive a nuclear blast? I mean, you did say they can withstand big doses of radiation.
Yeah, so tardigrades can survive up to about 10,000 gray of radiation. Sort of by contrast, we kind of wimpy humans can only survive about 10 gray exposure of radiation. Mm. So, you know, in terms of sort of ranking toughest animals in the world, I think you gotta put tardigrades up there at the top.
Thomas Boothby at the University of Wyoming, he was telling us about new research that showed how tardigrades can survive without water. Thomas, thanks very much.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
Queen Elizabeth's reign meant something very particular to citizens of the British Commonwealth. As we mentioned earlier in the show, that's a political association of 56 member states. Just a few years after Queen Elizabeth ascended to the throne, she was confronted with a rapidly devolving empire. British colonies in Africa, for example, gained independence and became republics. Historians say the young queen leveraged her charisma and influence to keep the newly independent nations within the Commonwealth. Reporter Ridwan Karim Edini Osman has a story of Queen Elizabeth's legacy in the West African nation of Ghana.
At the Baum Library at the University of Ghana, international relations student Cynthia Forson sits on a wooden chair as she flips through the pages of a book titled Elizabeth the Queen, The Life of a Modern Monarch. She says she received the book as a gift from her late aunt in 2016. Forson says news about the Queen of England's passing immediately took her mind back to her aunt and her time in middle school.
And we're learning about the Commonwealth countries and history. And we learned that the head was the queen and that she was this powerful woman who had taken over from her father at a very young age and been able to make a name for herself.
The 28-year-old says having read books and watched documentaries about Queen Elizabeth, she has always felt inspired to do more.
She's a woman and she has seen a lot, been through a lot, but come up with her head held high. So I think it's that inspiration and the fact that she was resilient.
Queen Elizabeth visited Ghana in 1961, a few years after Ghana had gained independence from colonial rule and become a republic.
Ghana, we now have freedom. Ghana, land of freedom.
Members of the British Parliament at the time were opposed to her travel as the accused then president, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, of turning into a dictator after leading Ghana to independence in 1957. 5 days before Queen Elizabeth's trip was to begin, bombs rained down in Ghana. A statue of Nkrumah was hit, which showed that the president was a target. Concerns about the Queen possibly becoming collateral damage while with him were heightened. But the Queen was determined, and the bombings did not alter that determination. Political historian Nana Esilfikundia says she wanted to pledge her support to independent Ghana.
Even though she had not been present in the handing over ceremony, had come to confirm the willingness and openness of mind and good wishes for the well-being of the country.
But there was more to the visit than that. Queen Elizabeth was aware that Ghana's first president, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, was getting closer to the Soviet Union, which wanted to expand its foothold in Africa amid the Cold War. The Ghanaian leader had even traveled to Moscow a month before her visit. Soviet attention toward Nkrumah apparently led to the Queen feeling a bit competitive. When she arrived in Ghana, she was met with euphoria from mammoth crowds who just wanted to catch a glimpse of her. At a state dinner, Queen Elizabeth obliged Dr. Kwame Nkrumah to a dance that caught the attention of the world, not only because it showed her anti-racist credentials, but also was symbolic of the new ties between Ghana and Britain.
And here was the monarch in a dance on a dancing floor.
Nkrumah then toasted Queen Elizabeth by saying, "The wind of change blowing through Africa has become a hurricane. Whatever else is blown into the limbo of history, the personal regard and affection which we have for Your Majesty will remain unaffected." In responding to the toast, the Queen emphasized that it was all right for nations of the Commonwealth to disagree without members needing to leave. But Nana Esilfikundia says the British monarch also leaves a troubling legacy when it comes to race and colonialism and its devastating impact on Black people. Kundia believes she could have better handled concerns of discrimination, especially regarding her relationship with mixed-race daughter-in-law Meghan Markle.
The idea of discrimination in Britain, the woman did not act decisively. We ought to have heard her voice loudly and clearly. She did not.
Following news of her death, President Akufo-Addo took to Twitter to commiserate with the royal family and has directed that all official flags in the nation fly at half-mast for 7 days. For the world, I am Ridwan Karim Dini Osman in Accra, Ghana.
What to do about energy come winter? For months now, Europe has been grappling with this. This week, EU leaders gathered to discuss emergency measures to keep energy costs down. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the goal is to wean the continent off of Vladimir Putin's natural gas.
You have seen that over the last month. He always tried to blackmail us. 13 member states have been partially or totally cut off the Russian gas already.
But how to break free from Russian gas? European lawmakers are divided on that question. To discuss the latest developments, I'm joined by Simone Tagliapietra. He's a senior fellow at Bruegel, a Brussels-based think tank focused on economics. So one of the main policies being debated is a price cap on gas. The UK's new prime minister, Liz Truss, is also considering a price cap policy. How would that work exactly, and why is that idea controversial?
Well, first of all, we need to clarify there are different options to do price caps. Number one, a price cap put on non-gas power generators. So in the current situation where gas prices are very high in Europe, that high price sets the price also for renewable electricity or nuclear electricity. So one proposal is to cap the price of renewable and nuclear so not to allow these generators to get extra profits. The second option would be to put a price cap on all the imports of gas. This is a controversial proposal because then producers outside of Europe might not have the incentive to send the molecules to Europe as they do now. A third proposal would be not to put a price cap on all the gas imports, but only specifically on Russia. Several countries that today are still importing some Russian gas, such as, for example, Greece, Austria, or Italy, are against this measure because Putin is likely to react by cutting off also their supplies.
So you mentioned how Austria is concerned by the scenario in which no cap is imposed except for Russian imports. I mean, Vladimir Putin is unpredictable. Do we have any sense of how he'd really react to that or any of these ideas?
Well, as you say, Putin is unpredictable because we need to consider that Russia has already cut more than two-thirds of its supplies to Europe. So there seems to be a clear strategy from Russia here to cut Europe off gas in order to put Europe in a difficult situation, namely during the winter. So what Putin has said in the recent days is that should price caps been applied, he will then cut supplies. He might cut the supplies in any case during the winter. And that's exactly the reason why the Commission, the European Commission, wanted to push this idea of a price cap on Russian gas, because they might cut in any case.
So it seems like in this game, Putin has the short-term advantage, putting the squeeze on Europe for this winter anyway. Over time, though, could the advantage turn to the European Union? And how would that happen?
Yes, this is really all about timing. In the short term, cutting off this energy and namely gas trade is certainly easier for Russia because for Europe it's going to be suffering because the prices are very high, even if Europe manages to secure the quantities. But in the long term, this really represents the dismantle of Russia as an energy superpower. Russia has typically exported more than 60% of its gas to the European Union. It has always been its predominant market. Now that this is gone, possibly forever, Russia will end up being a minor partner in the energy relationship with China. And I don't think that's going to be very interesting for Russia as it was the relationship with the European Union, which has always been a market that has paid for its gas much more of what China used to pay and is currently paying.
So the need for a solution for energy independence has been accelerated by Putin's war in Ukraine. What do you think needs to happen to secure a longer-term energy security in Europe? Or is that also just about time?
I think we have a short-term problem in Europe. In a matter of a few years, Europe will be completely independent from Russian energy. The problem is this winter, next winter, when all this infrastructure are still not ready. In this period, Europe needs to tap into all the possible alternatives it has. Also, for example, using more coal in electricity generation, calibrating the use of gas in certain energy-intensive industries. I think it's very important to roll out all the possible green solutions, renewable energy or energy efficiency, because they are domestic and they can really decrease Europe's reliance on outside energy suppliers.
Simone Italia Pietra is with the economics think tank Bruegel. He joined us from Brussels. Simone, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Nowhere, it seems, is free from the effects of climate change, not even cyberspace. A new study in the journal The Lancet shows as outdoor temperatures increase, so does hate speech on Twitter. The world's Anna Kusma reports.
You ever notice that when it's really hot out, your nerves are a little frayed, patience a little short? It's pretty well established that higher temperatures mean more irritability and more violent crime.
And we were wondering if you can see a similar phenomenon online.
Annika Stickemusser is with the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. Her team looked at 4 billion geolocated tweets in the U.S. and combined that with 6 years of temperature data.
What we found is that online hate speech increases when daily maximum temperatures reach above or below a certain temperature range. So basically, people tend to be more aggressive online when it's too hot or too cold outside.
And when it was mild out, more peace.
In this range from about 54 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, we found that hate is quite low.
Above 86 degrees led to a lot more tweets with hateful language, attacks based on things like race, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Stekamasa says people spend a lot of time online. More violence on social media has a real-world impact. 4 in 10 American adults say they have been harassed online.
Hate speech online has been shown to have quite a profound impact on the mental health of the people who are impacted by it, especially people who are already at risk of marginalization.
The goal of this research is to show the insidious effects of a warming climate.
Things like mental health are not as present in the discussion as a lot of the kind of physical consequences of climate change, yes.
Stickemusse says she hopes this research will inspire policies that will address mental health and bring down emissions. For The World, I'm Anna Kusmer.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Stay cool and be nice. We'll see you right back here on Monday.